con Javi Aria. Copy Janavalaba, Irvartaria. Copy Janavalaba, Irvartaria. Yashoda Nandana. Prajajana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Prajajana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Put up the oh oh. Ajaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Ajaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jayam Vishwara Brahmacharya Sadri Prajit Charya Saparasita Sisila Rizdavanga Sisila Kiranda Swami Prabhupada Ki Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Samade Rabakta Brinda Ki Glories to the Assembled Devotees. Glories to the Assembled Devotees. Glories to the Assembled Devotees. Glories to Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Today we're looking at the Srimad Bhagavatam, and I think it's Canto 10, am I right? And it's Chapter 52, Rukmini's Message to Krishna. And which text is it? 12. Okay, and then we have a purport. Great. Okay. Let's go through this together. Tata Utpatya Tarasa Dayamana Tatad Ubhau Dashaika Yojanat Tungan Nipatatur Adho Bhuvi Tata Utpatya Tarasa Danyamana tathad ubhav dashaika yojanat tungan Nepetatur adhobuvi. Tata utpatya tarasa. Dayamana tatad ubhava. Dasaika yojanhatungana. Nepetatur adhobuvi. Tarasa Tayamana Tada Buddha Saika Jokta. Upatya Tarasa Ayamana Tata Durbao Shaika Yojana Tungan Nipeta Tur Adho Guvi. Tarasa Ayamana Tata Durbao Saika Yojana Tunga Kipeta Tur Adho Guvi Kata Upadyat Harasa Ayamana Tata Duba Saika Yojana Tunga Kipeta Tur Adho Guvi. Tataha, from it, the mountain. Utpatya, jumping. Tarasa, with haste. Dayamana, which were burning. Tatat, whose sides. Ubau, the two of them. Dasha'eka, 11. Yojanat, Yojanas, Tungat, high. Nipetatuhu, they fell. Addaha, down. Bhuvi, to the ground. Translation. The two of them suddenly jumped from the burning mountain, which was 11 yojanas high, and fell to the ground. Purport. 11 yojanas is approximately 90 miles. This was for a while. Okay, in the next text. Unseen by their opponent or his followers, O king, those two most exalted yadus returned to their city of Dwarka, which had the ocean as a protective moat. Text 14. Jarasandh, moreover, mistakenly thought that Balaram and Keshava had burned to death in the fire. Thus he withdrew his vast military force and returned to the Magadha kingdom. Text 15. As ordered by Lord Brahma, Raivata, the opulent ruler of Anartha, gave Lord Balaram his daughter Raivati in marriage. This has already been discussed in purport. The topic of Lord Krishna's marriage to Rukmini will now be discussed. By way of introduction, a brief mention is made by his brother Baladev's marriage this marriage was alluded to in the ninth canto of the Bhagavatam, third chapter, text 33 to 36. Okay. And now we're going to do 16 and 17. And the translation is, O hero among the Kurus, the Supreme Lord himself, Govinda, married Bhishmaka's daughter, Vaidarbhi, who was a direct expansion of the goddess of fortune. The Lord did this by her desire, and in the process, he beat down Shalva and other kings who took Shishupal's side. Indeed, as everyone watched, Sri Krishna took Rukmini, just as Garuda boldly stole nectar from the demigods. O hero among the Kurus, the Supreme Lord himself, Govinda, married Bhishmaka's daughter, Vaidarbhi, who was a direct expansion of the goddess of fortune. The Lord did this by her desire. And in the process, he beat down Shalva and other kings who took Shishupal's side. Indeed, as everyone watched, Sri Krishna took Rukmini, just as Garuda boldly stole nectar from the demigods. And purport was divine grace that we see Bhaktivedanta Srila Prabhupada. Should, what's add disciples? Yes, Hare Krishna. Yes, Hare Krishna. That would be non-different. Okay, should we charade this out? Tyrada? Should we charade it out? Okay. Okay. Srila Jiva Goswami gives the following profound comments on these two verses. The words Shriyo Matram indicate that beautiful Rukmini is a direct expansion of the eternal goddess of fortune. Therefore, she is worthy to be the bride of the personality of Godhead, as stated in the Brahma Samhita 567, Shriya Kanta Kanta Parama Purushaha. In the spiritual world, all the female lovers are goddesses of fortune, and the male lover is the Supreme Personality. Thus, Srila Jiva Goswami explains, Srimati Rukmini Devi is a plenary portion of Srimati Radharani. Okay. You know my game. You want to play? All right. The Kartika Mahatmya section of the Padma Purana states, Kaishure Gopa Kanyastha Yovane Raja Kanyaka. In childhood, Sri Krishna, he enjoyed cheating with the daughters of the coward men. And in his adolescence, he enjoyed with the daughters of kings. Similarly, in the Skanda Purana, we find this statement. Rukmini dvaravakyam tu radha vrindavane vane. Rukmini is in Dwarka, what Radha is in the forest of Vrindavan. Okay. The term Swayamvare here means by one's own choice. Although the word often refers to a formal Vedic ceremony in Halloween, in which an aristocratic girl may select her own husband, here it indicates the informal and indeed unprecedented events surrounding Krishna's marriage to Rukmini. In fact, Sri and Srimati Rukmini chose each other because of their eternal, transcendental love. Arigato! Thanks for helping out. Namo Shivaya Krishna Stai Bhattari Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Namami Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Vicharini Hira Vishnu Vishnu Yavadi Pascha Chatini Shatavini Hare Krishna. Someone had asked Prabhupada about, you know, it was, I believe the subject was broccoli. And, you know, somebody asked Prabhupada also about the order in which you eat your food from the thali. And his answer was the same. He said, it's a matter of choice. It's a matter of preference. So there's a lot of choices that we find as we go through life. And when I think about that topic of choice, I oftentimes think about the time when the various people were conscripted for the battle of Kurukshetra. And I also have to question whether even there was much of a choice. It was Krishna who was lying down, having a nap. And Duryodhan and Arjuna were trying to form their armies. Arjuna and Duryodhan ended up at Krishna's bedside about the same time. It was their positioning was different, though. Obviously, they would have been on top of each other. But it was Krishna who woke up, and he noticed that Arjuna was positioned at his feet, which is where devotees generally find themselves. It was Duryodhan, who was a little bit in the puffed-up category, who put himself close to the head and the chest of the Lord, hoping he could, you know, get the attention right away. Now, Krishna had something to offer in this warfare. He had himself, and Krishna, you know, included a few people's lives. And of course, gave liberation as well. So he was a fighter. This is Krishna's disposition, or at least it's one of them. He has many. But he's a good fighter. He knocked the crap out of a few people. And, so Krishna had himself, and then he also had an army of 1 million strong people. That's a big Akshahi, or I guess you call it. So many people could be part of your military force. So the two persons who came out of interest to see Krishna during his nap time had no their choice. Krishna said, okay, I'll give you an option. You two who are ready to go onto this battlefield, there is my army, well-equipped men, well-trained, 1 million of them. And then the other choice, the other option is you can have me, but I won't take up any arms. I'll just be who I am. So take your pick. And, but it was Krishna who actually offered a choice, but didn't at the same time. Because he said, now, Arjuna, I want you to say what is on your mind. It was you who I saw first when I opened my eyes. So first come, first serve. That was the kind of mentality, the philosophy behind that. And then Arjuna said, I want you. And you want me, unarmed, just me by myself. And what was going on in Duryodhan's mind was this, well, hallelujah, Haribol. Because Duryodhan's calculation in his mind, it's very materialistic. He's thinking numbers is what's important. Force is important in the form of numbers. And when we all know that in a democratic system, when people are on that campaign for political, you know, positions, it's all having to do with numbers. And provided that there's no, you know, like tampering with the ballots and It's all about numbers, you know, who the majority wins. And so that's because people have their choice. In the democratic system, you have a choice. Prabhupada actually did explain some of the, you know, let's say the shortcomings of that approach. Because if people are not in a good discerning position, or they don't have good discriminating power, then you're going to end up everyone voting for the guy that's going to offer the most sense gratification, right? And the person who's very much keen to offer what we call shreyas and prayas, or prayas would be, I'm going to give you a lot of sense grad. I'm going to give you a lot of pleasure, and it will come just as soon as, as of tomorrow, okay? As of tomorrow, you'll get all this sense gratification, because that's what you want. So prayas means that immediate pleasure. And as Krishna states in the Gita, that which in the beginning seems really like a lot of fun usually ends up being troublesome at the end. And that which in the beginning is a little bit inconvenient, a little bit troublesome, out of the way, and so on, hurts just a slight bit. Usually that ends up being like nectar in the end. So when we think about where many people are at, and in our capitalistic society, we definitely are by choice people thinking, well, what's good for me right now? What's good? And it was told to me by one of our Floridian devotees that our indigenous people here in Florida, they had a mood or a mindset that whenever the elders made a decision and discuss things together, they would think about, I heard it was 8 generations before. Whatever decision we make now will impact 8 generations. We're thinking that far ahead. Is that the way it is right now? No way, Jose. No way, Jose. So that's the way it is. So we pride ourselves on this choice, and it's great, but if you have the right people choosing, it's great. I think democracy, it's a great thing if you have Brahmins doing all the voting. And that's Vedic culture, and Brahminical people decide. Because why is it important for Brahminical input? Because they're thoughtful people. Because they study the Shastra. They have a good sort of a hold on, a good pulse of the people. They have a good understanding of what was back behind, what's happening in the front and before us, you know, and what's going on in the here and the now. Brahminical people have that ability. They're the visionary people. Even Kshatriyas, you have to watch that classification of people. They're extremely valuable. I know where I stay at Anantashesham, Vaishnavi's place when I come here. And on their street, there's a husband and wife team. They're both police officers. And they park their car on the road so that people will think twice about doing some nonsense. So Kshatriyas, the police force, they offer a great service to humanity, but they're not usually the people that make choices. They're the ones that say, I'll do what the policy is. You know, whatever the policy is laid down, I'll follow that. Whatever the king says, whatever is established, like say by the collective powers, the choices of the people together, the power of the people collectively, that's what we'll do. That's what we'll do. So they generally do that. And because they're people of passion, it's probably a better idea that they don't get involved in a lot of the decision making. Although, in their training with martial arts, they have to know how to control their powers, their psychic and physical powers, and they'll know when to strike. It's a training. You know, it's not that if you're a fighter, the Kshatriya is not just a fighter, not just a street gang fighter. There's a world of difference between the two. You know, there's lots of discretionary power that is invested in the Kshatriya community, and basically they will not strike unless a superior tells them. That's the way it is. Remember the time in the Mahabharata Arjun, he had Ashwatthama, you know, by the collar. And he looks back, and he's looking at his superiors, and he says, so should I end his life now after being an infanticide and an artist, after killing babies in their sleep? You know, how lowly, how cowardly. So he's looking back. And who was he looking back at? Does anybody know? Draupadi, and who else? Krishna and Yudhishthira. Anybody else? Bhima, right. So the Pandavas were there, right? And then, so everyone was given the choice. And he was ready to do a nice decapitation program, you know, like whatever was required, whatever was necessary. So Draupadi, what did she say? She had a choice, and what did she say? No. And mother, right? And what did Krishna say? Does anybody remember? He was kind of like involved to some degree. Okay, let's go to Bhima. What did he say? Off with his head. Okay. Anybody else had comments to make? You have to figure this out. So Krishna stood in the middle. And after all this play of choice went on, he stood there, and it's one of those great moments when Krishna suddenly becomes Vishnu. He says, okay, you have your choice. You have your say, fine. Okay, you have your say over here, and you have your say, and you have your say. So the four hands had to be out there so the settlement could be made. It was beautiful, actually. So it was decided that Ashwatthama would live. And he apparently still does. And his influence is pervasive, wouldn't you say? Yeah, I'm given a choice. Yes or no? It's all about choice. Would you say that his nature, his mentality, being in Kali Yuga, being what it is, what it stands for, what it represents, do you think that his influence is around us? Absolutely, 100%. So, we're talking about choices here. Krishna and Rukmini, they had this program going on. Rukmini simply heard about Krishna, didn't even see a picture of him, just the description was there, and immediately it was love at first, not sight, love at first sound. And Krishna had a good idea of who he was dealing with as far as Rukmini is concerned. And there was an agreement that there would be we call it kidnapping, but it's, or an abduction, but actually it's not. It was a consensual thing, 100% consensual. It was an elopement, maybe that would be the better word. And so, as you know, everyone was ready for this Swayamvara. There was a choice, or let's say princes had to come forward and offer some kind of, you know, feat demonstrating their powers as a Kshatriya. But it was ultimately a decision that Rukmini was resting with her. And so her decision was, of course, she was supposed to be married to, actually she was supposed to be married to someone that was a choice person. Does anybody remember that? Shishupal, that's right. And as far as she was concerned, she couldn't stand his guts. There was one, when I went to Baltimore, the last time I went to Baltimore, there was one devotee there who just fell in love with the story of the elopement of Krishna and Rukmini, and he decided to do like a screenplay, a script for like a feature film of the story, and he wanted me to read it. And the opening scene is just before, like when Rukmini is just about ready to be married, and all this tension builds up, and now everybody's all excited, and the crowds are out there, and she happens in the script, she happens to released her breakfast. So that I'm not saying that was child's trick. It was just the message that was being conveyed was, I don't like this guy. I don't want to go through this. Is Krishna really coming? And she did send a letter, a total love letter. Krishna, I just want you. Forget about everything else. And please get me. So the wedding was about to be on, and the ceremony was about to begin. Like that saying goes, the ceremony is about to begin. And the Rukmini, with some of her female friends, went to Durga, the goddess, if they could call it, for some kind of blessings before the knot was tied, you know, so to speak. And, well, very heroically, Krishna came in at the right moment, and like a perfect drama, all this tension and suspense is built up, and suddenly, boom, he comes in and snatches her, just like Garuda who snatches a deer. Okay, maybe it's possible. Is that Gopal? Is that you? Try again. It's not a deer. I'll give you a hint. It slithers around on the ground. Snake. Right, exactly. And this he did. And just before everybody's eyes, you know, you can imagine like trying to deal with crowds. Anybody ever been to India before? Anybody here been to India before? You know what crowds are all about, you know. And, you know, it can be really, really tough. The traffic. You know, Hari Bol, try to get through that traffic. I just came back, Tamaharpa knows, we just came back from Tirupati, and I stopped in Hyderabad, and it was rush hour, unfortunately. And I was watching one older man trying to get through, like, 8 lanes of traffic, and I was watching him with great intent. Oh my God, is he gonna do that, you know? And walking across traffic going this way, traffic going that way, you know? And, you know, he made it, he did it. When he did it, I said, Hari Bol! It was the greatest thing. I remember seeing in Delhi some school kids that were like blue clothes, that was their color tone for their school. And it was a little boy and a little girl, brother and sister, I would assume. And she was a little older. And they had to go through the same kind of traffic. Not just with traffic, but with dust. You know, and it, you know, stirring up in the air, you know. And I could see them from the other end. They were coming. And from where I was, they were coming to my side of the street. And you know, the honking. The honking and the dust and everything. And when I saw them, just they came, and it was like an everyday experience. You know, wow, how did they do that? So, also when I think about the Battle of Kurukshetra, how Krishna was a great person to manipulate himself through the crowds, through the dust, stirred up by the horses, by the wheels of the chariots, and how his chariot would go, hit the ground, go up off the ground, and you know, just like you know, one of those kind of high tech movies that you see, and he's just up and around all over. He maneuvered himself so well. He was great at it. You know? So whenever I see a cab driver, I just think, you guys have got the mercy of Krishna, of God. Especially the yellow cab drivers in Manhattan. So it is, Krishna maneuvered himself through the crowds, and then he was able to pick her up, you know. It was one of the last times I came to Florida. I stayed with one devotee, and there's like a pond by his house. So we kept, you know, it takes one round to walk around this pond or this lake. And what happened was there was this, we were just chanting, minding our own business, and this hawk came and just missed us by 1 foot, came down and took off. And it was a good size one, too. Like it was just such shakti, such empowered energy that these creatures have. Another friend of mine, he was This is in British Columbia. He was watching this fox chasing a rabbit. And it was a fierce chase. And the fox was getting closer and closer and closer. And just as he was about to grab this rabbit, this poor rodent, an eagle came and picked him up. And the fox just... And then he was digging his legs, so frustrated, you know. So Krishna's target on, he's just like really on his target, and he gets what he wants. You know? So he was interested in Rukmini, and it was totally mutual, and so there was a choice, a lot of choices out there. I remember in the first walk I did across Canada, I was entering into the, you know, the sort of real incredible wilderness of this, what we call the Shield, you know, where it's the oldest rock in the world, and trees and rocks and lakes are everywhere. So one guy, he pulled over in a red sports car, and he was like a Filipino background person, and, but raised in Canada. And he said, you know, I read about you in the paper, and can you talk for a minute? He said, sure. I said, well, he said, you can get inside. So here I am, a monk sitting in a little red sports car. I felt kind of good for a while. And he said, you know, something happened in my life. I was wondering if you could help me through this. I was going to study with a girlfriend for 5 years, and we were going to get married. And she just took off with my best friend. So, can we talk? Okay. All right, so then I was put to the task of being a little bit of a counselor. And I said, well, you know, don't worry. You know, there's lots of other opportunities that are there for you. 50% of the population is female, so you got a big choice. I don't know, I just had to say whatever I could. Then after, I was just trying to console him, and then after I could take him to the spiritual platform and tell him about chanting, I gave him a mantra card, and I told him, please try to do this, it'll calm the mind, it'll make the mind peaceful, and so you can bear the pain, and you know, you will get over it, time heals. All the kind of things that would comfort a person's mind after having gone through something like that. So with our choices, I guess we have to be very, very careful. Oh, by the way, he did. I did get out of the car, and I did walk the rest of the way. So we have many choices in life. Every day you have to make many choices, many decisions. Every day. As to when to leave and go, shall I be late, shall I be on time, shall I be early, which car should I take, which clothes should I wear. Of course, for devotees, it's kind of easy, right? They have to be clean. That's the only choice we have. Especially when it comes to temple clothing, right? But otherwise, we all dress the same. Like, one dhoti fits all sizes, one sari fits all sizes. But it is a question of choice, right? Somebody might not like green. The guys have it easier, right? I must admit. Because we don't have as many choices. We don't have to get into that. But the ladies might have to say, honey, should I wear this purple one or should I? Is it like that? Oh, you don't ask. Yeah, because Manoram will say, whatever you want. We know him very well. Yeah, so, but more important decisions are there. Like, I think a big issue for devotees is our food. It's very rich. And we have a lot of festivals every day. And it's all rich. And all comes from obedience. It has to be rich. And so you have to make a decision. How much of this richness will I dig myself into? And how much, and should I not even take some of it? And, you know, and of course, your body is its own guru, and it will tell you what you should take and what you should not. The tummy is like a voice box. You know, the tongue is not. the eyes are not, you know, because one will super duper, like, you know, garnish subjis with all the colors you can imagine, flowing in ghee, flavorful like anything, and it's organic. And devotees grew, it was done with love, you know. And then, you know, so it's really hard. So the eyes say yes. The tongue, you know, the watering process, whatever, goes on, yes. Okay. The nose says yes. The memory also says yes, because it was an ecstatic experience in the past. But then the intelligence says no. Or puts a stopper on it, or at least it puts a check on it, you know. So we have those kind of choices to make. And, of course, everybody's living in this world, so we have to deal with money. We have to make wise decisions. Some of us are not good at making decisions with money. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told one of his followers, now you help this poor soul, because he makes all the wrong decisions with money, his currency. So you help him out. You be his financial advisor. Well, that's the way it goes. So you take help from where you can. Don't think you're God, that you can do everything, that you're good at everything. Well, sometimes you have to let other people make decisions. You can't just all do it on yourself. You know, only God has that prerogative. So somehow we have to stop playing God. I think it's a really good idea. You think it's a good idea? I mean, playing God is what got us into trouble in the first place. I mean, I think we mentioned that phrase before. I think it's a good idea. Somebody said to Gandhi, he said, what do you think about Western culture? And he said, I think it's a very good idea. It's a good idea. Yeah, maybe it'll start someday. So, think like that. Turn right, turn left. Shall I sleep a little extra? Shall I get up now? Because it's time for temple activity. Shall I say thank you? And of course, you can never say enough thank yous to people. Most of the day, we should be saying thank you. And we really appreciate it. Say something good about other people, and once you do that, they'll love you, and they'll be nice to you too. Yeah. So it shouldn't even be a choice. You know. Should we smile? I'm just talking mundane, right? Shall we smile? Well, why don't you look into the face of the Supreme Personality of God and ask God himself, should we smile? What do you think the answer is? Ask his best friend right next to him. And then there are lots of choices up here. You can ask any of the Murtis here. Ask those two personalities with their arms like this. The rest should smile. And then there's also the trio, the famous trio over there, Jagannath, Baladev, and Subhadra. Ask them if you should smile or not. And then the answer would be, it's pretty obvious, you know, like reflect it. Yes. And why should I be doing that? Why should I even be? Sounds like some mundane advice, like smile and everything will be okay. Actually, could anybody give me an answer why it's good to do that? Other than the fact that they're doing it and Prabhupada did it quite often. That would be good. Pardon me? It reflects happiness and it brings about happiness. Any other reason why smiling would be a good thing to do? Yes. Okay. So it reflects what a devotee really is. What would be another reason why somebody should smile? Because it shows gratitude and appreciation. Sure. Chant and be happy. So the smiling goes along with that. Mm-hmm. It's our true nature to smile. You're smiling inside. Oh, that's good. You have a good smile, by the way. Yes. shows that a door is open.
Yeah.
Good. You were willing to communicate. Yes, that's very good. Yes, Tamar, please. It is part of the process of devotional service, prasanatma. Yes, prasanatma, to joy, to be jolly, to be happy. Yes, it's very important. Yes, yeah, this is great. You get 108 answers. Smiling is contagious. It's a good thing. Good, good. So it's a great, it's like a disease. It's contagious. Yeah. It's a good one. So, yes. Doesn't cause dissent, right? Yes. Yes. Yeah. Right. So you make it. And yeah, even if you're not feeling it, maybe it says plastic smile. yes. Eventually you get used to stretching the muscles a little bit. yes, yes. Right, right. It takes less muscle. But maybe to frown, if it's more muscles, then it's a better workout to frown. I'm just joking. Yeah. Even from the point of view of productivity, when there's people smiling around and kind of jolly, more things get done. There's more output. You know, even if you're like you're a slave driver, but you do it with a smile, you probably get a little bit more. Yeah, those are really good answers. Thank you for training them up. So, just to go back to the shloka, what time should? How long should we go to? I'm not sure what the program is here. We should wind it down. Okay, wind it down. So I'm just going to go here with the verse one more time, and then we'll go for your questions and your comments. Okay? O hero among the Kurus. The Supreme Lord himself, Govinda, married Bhishmaka's daughter, Vaidarbhi, who was a direct expansion of the goddess of fortune. The Lord did this by her desire, and in the process, he beat down Shalva and other kings who took Shishupal's side. Indeed, as everyone watched, Sri Krishna took Rukmini just as Garuda boldly stole nectar from the demigods. Hare Krishna. So any comments? Yes. Democracy. Mm-hmm.
Asking about democracy. That the would seem like it's the realm of the Vaishya community,
mm-hmm.
but the Sudras, they could maybe be better utilized or whatever in a communistic situation,
mm-hmm.
and enlightened Brahmins can give information to Kshatriyas. Kshatriyas would be like monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just asking about these different types of organizing society. You've mentioned that democracy among the Brahmins would be good, but I would think that just their enlightened clarity of the scriptures and giving that clarity to the other members of society would be enough.
I think you put it very well. That's my understanding of the Vedic system. And I'm glad you asked that question, not while we're sitting in Cuba. So, the decisions are made by those persons who are able to process various issues and be able to digest the knowledge, the jnanam, and able to see what's good for the whole community, for the general public. So that would be the enlightened Brahmins. Yes. We shouldn't forget that they spend years and years and years cultivating communication with people, being sensitive to people's needs. Many Brahmins were doctors. You know, they understood what the social and spiritual needs and physical needs were for the people. And so for them to make the decisions, the democracy that we people talk about should be amongst that category of people, for sure. And so what we have in our democratic system, yeah, you're absolutely right. The American dream is all about, you know, making money, getting ahead, and things like that. And, but very much putting the spiritual element to the side. And I think that American culture started off with good intent. With where the acknowledgement of this God, the Supreme Being, but very quickly it's plummeted down, and Dharma was there, some level of Dharma, let's put it that way, whatever meaning Dharma is. Dharma, Artha, you know, get yourself established, and then Kama, have a lot of fun, and then after that it drops off, there's no moksha. No consideration for motion. So it's all pretty much selfish kind of, culture, and those are the people who are voting for us. And therefore, democracy bemoaned, as Prabhupada used to say. Yeah, he used to say that. Yeah. We're going to see, I mean, we're already seeing the ill effects of it that's working against us. It's already very much working against us. But it maybe somebody else would like to say something along these lines.
Yeah, actually, for the record, I just read over our ballot because we're voting soon. And I was realizing there's so many things on there, so many faces, and so many people, that it would require a great deal of work just to really discern what is the what's the best course to take.
Right.
And the majority of people are too busy. They're not going to take the time, so they're just going to vote whoever is going to give them the most. And it's a difficult thing. Srila Prabhupada, in the Bhagavatam, it says that, what Prabhupada says, I heard on a tape yesterday, he said, demon crazy, he says it's just simply the government are plunderers. They're not pickpockets, you know, you kind of praise pickpockets, but the government, they take money.
The Lord giveth and the government taketh away.
It's actually, for sudras, you know, it's actually easier to be directed, you know, do this, do that, and you don't have to make so many choices.
Mm-hmm.
You give it to somebody who really knows.
So just what you're saying is that would put people to ease when they know they don't have to give the time to, you know, make these major decisions and try to figure out who this person is and what they're talking about, how much truth is really coming out of them, or are they just have the gift of gab, but is it really just self-motivations behind it? Usually that's what it is. You know? And that's why you have a constant recycling of these people, and why you have to vote, what is it, every 4 years? Every 4 years. Okay, next. You know. Okay, I thought that person was going to help me out, but no way. Next, and just always, everyone's cut from the same cloth, you know, pretty much. And so therefore, what you're saying is we save a lot of time. If Brahminical people can actually make these choices, because they understand, they're like psychologists, too. They understand human nature, they understand the three energies, sattva-guna, rajagun, tamaguna, what motivates people. So they would be the best people to make decisions on who should be ruling. Yeah. Very good point. Democracy, to put it in plain English, just ain't working out.
just a quick mention of Dr. Scott, who's going to be initiated today, gave a Bhagavad Gita to Charlie Crist, who's running for governor, and he wanted to sing that. So, I mean, I don't think he's any great devotee or, you know, Charlie Crist or anything special, but somehow or another, he had a little bit of piety that he was able to get a Bhagavad Gita. So sometimes I make my decision like that, and Obama, you know, had that figure of Hanuman to be carried with him. So, you know, at least you probably they're not real demons, at least, you know, if they have some attraction to Krishna in that way. But what I was going to I was going to ask you on a totally different topic. You know, in the next couple of years, 2015 and 16, you're celebrating the 50th anniversary of Shri Prabhupada coming to America, and then, of course, in preparation of this time, 2016. I know that you have a very interesting part in that as far as your walking seva. Could you tell us about that, what you're doing?
Sure, I don't mind. And before I say something on that, is that Prime Minister Modi, you know, the new Prime Minister in India, is very liked by people. And he's been giving Bhagavad Gita to, you know, a lot of world leaders in his first visit to them. So, you know, there's some hope for the culture to, let's say, come up to some level. Okay, as far as the walking seva goes, I got to learn that the word walking comes from an old German word, walken, which comes from the Sanskrit word valgati, which means to walk. So, anyways, as far as Prabhupada's, with the celebration for next year, his coming to the American soil, the plan is to start on the date which corresponds to the solar calculation of when he came to America, and to walk from the Boston Harbor to Butler, Pennsylvania. For everybody knows what Butler represents, Butler, Pennsylvania, and then from there to New York City. And then that goes, okay, because Prabhupada spent a good amount of time in Butler. Now, he did go to New York, but as I understand, very quickly from there on, he went to Butler, spent a month there, and then he spent a good amount of time in New York. So that's the plan. It'll take maybe about 6 weeks, and we need your blessing. And then the year after 2016, if all goes well with the first walk, we'll see how the American public responds to this, and I'm sure it'll be good. Then we'll walk from New York City, just like Prabhupada has kind of moved, you know, to the other end of the other coast. So the idea is to walk from New York City to San Francisco via we'll do a good chunk of the Lincoln Highway, which is the first highway that was built across the country. So we thought that, I was talking to Anutama about it, we thought that maybe this would be a good idea, and also Manoram, we talked to Manoram because we travel a lot together, that because Prabhupada's coming is a historical event, and then everybody, Lincoln being the most favored president of them all, you know, this first high was after his name, so putting those kind of like heartfelt sentiments together, about maybe that would be a good way to go. So that would take maybe about 5 months to do that. And we need your blessings on that one, too. That's the gift that we could offer. We have a little experience in that area. And I think the American public would be really receptive, and because people are quite outgoing, and I think it'll work. So thank you for bringing it up. Just in the back.
Haribol Maharaj, thanks for the nice lecture.
Talk.
You've mentioned about the choices that we were making and everything, and you mentioned about eating and the food, the prasadam and everything. Do you think we're ready for some kind of a reform in the way we eat in ISKCON? And, you know, I know you're doing a lot of physical activity and everything, and I know we have certain standards of what we can offer to the deities and everything, but can you talk a little bit of the habits that we have in ISKCON and what we give to our kids and everything and those huge feasts and everything? Do you think there's a...
Well, I know for a fact that a lot of devotees, they have diabetes issues and heart issues and so on like that. And one of the reasons is that our food is very rich and we don't have any controls and we don't do enough exercise. That's a fact. That's 100% fact. And in my travels, that's what I'm finding out, but we're just not doing enough to take care of ourselves. So as far as reform goes, Well, I had, that's one of the reasons I started walking, just to get away from the temple food. Honest. Scout's honor. Like, honest. And it was necessary for me to eat what I wanted to eat, what I needed to eat, and to get a little more into a little more raw things and raw foods and the things that I like, you know, and staying away from sugars, especially white sugar and white anything. Do you remember Melanie, the old from the 60s? She wrote a song. She was way ahead of her time. She says, "And I don't eat animals as they don't eat me." And then in the lyrics, it was all about, she was talking about white flour and white sugar, how it was not good for you there. So that was decades now. And so we should be looking at that, what's good for us. And you know, just to follow through with what Prabhupada wanted. I mean, he wanted us to have our own controlled environment. He wanted us to grow our own food. He wanted us to have nice, tasty food that could be offered to the deities. And you know, and it, you know, whatever may go to the deities doesn't mean that's my food necessarily. We used to talk about rice, tolerance, qualities, things like that. And it would depend a little bit too on what kind of work you do. Most of us don't work hard. We don't work like in the fields, which can justify, you know, the heavy food. Because you'll just burn it all up. I think it's a good point to bring up, and that we should be looking at more healthy food. So individually, I see devotees are doing it, but collectively, as a culture, we're not doing much about it. Personally, I like to see at a festival two rows of pots of food. And one row, there should be a sign up. There should be two signs up for both rows. Where people line up and say, "Rich food, healthy food." And then you're not offending the rich people, but you're making a statement at the same time. This is what's ultimately good for you. And this row may be tasty, but it may not be so, you know, for the long run, healthy for you. So, do you want to start a movement? I mean, you're French, right? So, revolutionary, let's go for it. I'm right behind you. Anything else, Papoose? Yes. You had a question, and the microphone's coming to you.
So the question is, it's been a long time, curious question. In to say Aswatthama or Rukmini and Rukmini's brother, now they were either going to be killed, forever dead, gone, or get their hair cut. And that's what they ended up doing, and it's always been very, and the only thing I can kind of think about it similar to is like a scarlet letter or something, which has to be worn, I don't even know for how long, but it's like a symbolic of their behavior. So that was my question, is what is the hair, how is that? And the other thing is, I'm curious about your teaching in Cuba.
Okay, so the first one was to do with the particular hairdo. Yeah, right. And that was supposed to be a branded mark of like a humiliation statement. It was like as soon as the public could see you, you know, you're a rascal, you know, you'll be frowned down upon. It was a dishonor. It was like a court martial gesture, like physically. Of course, hair grows in, and so just maybe the humiliation only goes on for so long. But at least in Vedic culture, we understand this was a sign of, let's say, you've been a bad boy. I think that happened in World War II. And some of the women were fooling around with the enemy, you know, like philandering, and they were caught, and they would have their heads shaven, and then the public would have an attitude towards them, you know, why have you been doing this with the enemy? So I don't know if it applies so much now. In fact, people really appreciate it. Hey, give me a free haircut. You know, like, No, and especially if it looks weird. The weirder you are, the more in vogue you are. It's sort of like a punk style. Yeah, and so that's what I want to say on that. As far as Cuba goes, I go every year to Cuba. I keep in touch with Ichwaku. He's a school teacher in Miami, Cuban born, and he's the regional secretary for Cuba. So he keeps a pulse on people. He travels there maybe 3 times a year. And it's not easy for a Cuban born person living in Miami to get there. It's very difficult. They don't make it easy for you when you go through customs. But I would just say the people are so receptive. And I don't know if you would say they're oppressed, but they definitely don't have all the things at their disposal like we do in America. But when I go there, I see what's the name of the wall there? On the south shore by Havana. I forget the name of it, but some people might call it Lover's Lane. There's a lot of people who just kind of hang out there, put their legs over the wall, look at the ocean, and just dream away about going to Miami. The land of Maya and me. The land of, self-aggrandizement, where you can get everything you want, you know. And then I've actually been in Miami to a Cuban festival. And then when I compare the people who have been kind of established there in Miami to the people in Cuba, I said, don't bother going to the U.S. Don't bother, you get spoiled, you know. Or if it's Cuba, it doesn't matter. And, people that look physically very fit, they don't eat a lot. They eat enough, and I never see obese people there. I've actually made a deliberate effort to go. We've been to a lot of different towns, cities. Nobody's obese there, and yet nobody's undernourished. So there's some Vedic elements there. They put a big push for the monarchy, or whatever you want to call it. I'm not saying it's all clean, for sure. It's not, but some other people have been, I'd say, maybe a little deprived. Their lives have been, simplicity has been imposed upon them. And they're just so ready and ripe for Krishna consciousness. They're so eager and enthusiastic. And you can be in a room full of people. And I remember we played, remember the old documentary, Wherever Well Wisheth? Last year when I was there, in early December, we rented a movie house. Well, you don't even rent it. It's a culture house. And we refurbished it. And so we invited people to come to this, our presentation with us in Kirtan. And we also showed that documentary with Spanish subtitles. So when people are looking at it, and they're just bawling out. They're just so touched by Prabhupada, you know. They're very emotional people. Very loving kind of people. And they deserve a chance. They deserve a chance. So whatever y'all can do to help out in some way, that would really be appreciated. They're not far from us. And they're just struggling souls like anybody else. And what else to say? First of all, when it comes to food, we're getting back to food. Most persons just eat like a real poor man's kind of rice and then beans. It's boring. We usually come with our chat masalas and in the suitcases and bring whatever we can. But whatever veggies you can get there and fruits, so tasty because they don't use any pesticides. When Russia pulled out, they didn't give, they didn't have the money. So they just grow everything organically. And the avocados, man. Tomatoes taste like tomatoes, like they're supposed to. Does anybody know what food tastes like? The way it used to taste? I was raised on a farm. And it was so good. I think somewhere around early 80s, they just tampered so much with it. It was
the food doesn't taste.
It's perfect. And so, hence Prabhupada wanted us to have our farms, our agricultural communities. So at least we can start to do some gardening. At least. We're going to get a microphone to you because people are hearing, I understand, all over the world.
I've seen different stories about Cuba that because the shortage of vehicles and oil and so forth, that the people there have used oxen for years, and that that's the primary mode for agriculture there. I just wondered if that's true or not.
Well, actually, I've done some walking in the countryside, like just like outside of towns. I can't remember it's not Santa Clara. It was another place, but I saw some tractors. I saw some oxen. I also saw a breed of cows like they have in Vrindavan. Yeah, yeah. So when I walk around, whether it's in the countryside or in the streets. In Cuba, I just think there's a lot of India there. There's a lot of simplicity. People are very happy to meet them. One thing that's a marked difference between here and there, nobody is plugged in. You can just hola right in their face. It's kind of nice. And that'll change. It'll get smaller. No cow slaughter? Oh, that might be. Well, you might be right. I don't know. Yeah, they come down very hard on pornography and different things that goes on that people try to slide in. So there are some good values there. Everyone gets a university education, and your health needs are met. So that's all taken care of. That's a good thing. But people do live in simple, tight, small circumstances. And I think those of us who are spoiled by North American lifestyles could have a hard time. I think one of the real charming elements of the place, though, is like 50% of the cars are those old models. They're old American cars with Russian engines. And it's like the whole place is like a big museum. Really nice to see. I mean, the cars of today are... All right, anything else? Yeah. You want to stand up with the temple prasadam? All right.
Only festival days we usually have the rich prasadam. Most of the days the breakfast,
it's simple.
Most have khichdi or something very simple, and then the lunch is usually rice, festival days that is.
Okay.
So is that bad having festival day come in?
Sounds like a good program to me. Yeah, you go on a you go on a Tiaga program, and then when it comes to a festival, just go all out and sin.
I mean, it's still rich, but it's not like...
Right. Well, fabulous. That's a great report for everybody. I think it's... nice to hear that, but that's we're considering people's health. Okay, so thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada.